Hi, and welcome back to the Souls Podcast. My name is Liv, and I will be your interviewer today. Today, we're going to be chatting to Felicity Raw. Felicity is a partner at the commercial law firm Allens, and she specialises in environment and planning law. She's been recognised as a top E&P lawyer in Chambers and Partners, Best Lawyers, Doyle's Guide, and is Vice President of the New South Wales Environment and Planning Law Association. But most importantly, she, like our listeners, is UCIT alumni. Felicity, thank you so much for joining us today and welcome to the Souls Podcast.
Thanks, Liv. It's great fun to join you.
Great. So we might just start off with get you to tell us a little bit about how you started out in Sydney Law and then became a partner at Allens.
Sure. Well, that didn't all happen in 5 minutes, let me tell you. So I did a combined arts and law degree at Sydney Uni. So people often ask me, as an E&P lawyer, do I have a science background? The answer is no. I've got a degree in English and history, which has actually got nothing at all to do with what I do, but it was quite fun at the time. So when I graduated from uni, I took a graduate position at Allens. I didn't do a clerkship because at the time my parents were living overseas, so I went to the UK and did a clerkship in the UK instead, just for something different, and then went through the graduate recruitment round and landed a job at Allens. I didn't have anybody in my family who'd been a lawyer. I didn't really know any lawyers before I started, so it was all a bit new to me. But I started my career here at Allens because I thought it looked like a great place to work and had a fantastic art collection on the walls. So it wasn't all that scientific a choice, if I have to be honest. And then I had the best part of 17 years here at Allens, including a couple of periods of parental leave while I had my children. Then I left the firm in 2007 to join another firm where I was a partner for 10 years and then came back to Allens to lead the E&P practice at the beginning of this year.
Fantastic. So what were you like in law school?
What was I like? I wasn't there all that often, to be honest. I wasn't a sort of party animal on campus. I lived at home and commuted every day to uni. I did spend my fair share of time in the Manning Bar and hanging out with friends. But I wasn't super active in clubs and societies at uni. And I think, law students who we see today and certainly the people we interview for grad and clerkship positions are much more involved in the life of the university, involved in Souls and involved in clubs and societies, and generally have a much better idea of what the opportunities are on campus and take them up than I certainly did.
So considering all that, how did you end up in commercial environment and planning law? And I guess for those who don't know, what does that actually look like?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. And I'm not sure that I really had any idea when I started either. So I'd studied environmental law at university and that was quite fun. It was quite interesting. You were dealing with threatened species and trees and planning law and pollution. And environmental law was quite a new subject area, if you like, at that time. So it was quite a fun thing. It was not nearly as dry as some of the other things I might have studied, but I won't name what those areas were. So I was quite attracted to the idea that you were dealing with tangible things and forests and water pollution and threatened species and sort of things you could touch and see. So I thought that would be quite interesting. But when I started practice in 1991, in commercial law firms, environmental law was also a new thing. And it was at the time when firms were just starting to develop and identify their own standalone areas of practice as environmental law. And indeed, when I started at Allens, there wasn't a standalone environmental law practice. So over the first couple of years that I was here, Allens, like many of the other top-tier firms at that time, were just sort of arranging themselves, identifying it as a new area of law and identifying that there was a market that they should talk to clients about and identify people who had an interest and a specialty in that area. So that sort of process of reinvention happens really, all the time in law firms. 10 years ago, 15 years ago, technology as a practice of as an area of legal practice wasn't really something, I guess, that people talked about. Blockchain and smart contracts weren't things that people had really talked about or thought about. And so as technology evolves, as practice evolves, as the workplace in which our clients operate evolves, new areas of law emerge and people develop an interest and they might write a paper or do some research and suddenly they're an expert on it. So that's how I sort of came into the firm. I chased the environmental law practice around the firm for the first couple of years when I was here. It wasn't a standalone practice. So I did two rotations in sort of related areas where I thought I would do some environmental law but actually didn't do very much. And then by the time I finished those rotations, the firm had established a standalone practice area, and that's where I landed and that's where I stayed.
Fantastic. So maybe to give everyone a little bit more of an idea of what you do on the day-to-day, could you tell us about what an interesting matter you've worked on?
Sure. So environmental law is a really interesting mix of litigation work and advisory work and a little bit of transactional work as well. So you get that sort of whole range of the spectrum of types of legal work that you could do in a commercial law firm. So one of the most exciting and long-running matters that I worked on in the 90s was in relation to what's now the entertainment quarter at Fox Studios. So we, as a firm, acted for Fox Studios, who acquired that site or an interest in that site when it was still owned by the state government as the Royal Agricultural Showground. So it's where the Easter Show used to be, if people are old enough to remember that. That's where I went to the Easter Show when I was a kid. And it's an incredible historic precinct that has been used by the Royal Agricultural Society for, I can't remember how many years, probably 100 years or close to. So many of the buildings and the showground arena have very important heritage significance, but it was a site that was falling into disrepair and was struggling to be sort of renewed and reused for the original purpose. So the state government decided to transform it into an entertainment and filmmaking precinct, if you like. And so I was lucky enough to work with Fox Studios on that whole journey from their first involvement with the site to the process of rezoning the site to allow those sorts of uses to be able to be used, through to working with all sorts of architectural, heritage, town planning consultants to develop the detailed proposal to, I guess, reinvent those facilities for filmmaking and other entertainment purposes, which was an incredible journey.
Wow.
And, you know, that was a process that took a number of years. It involved a couple of side trips into litigation where some groups of residents of the nearby area brought proceedings to challenge the validity of some of the planning controls that had been introduced because they were, I don't know why they were opposed to the project, but they had some concerns about the manner in which the decision making had happened. So we had there was some litigation in the Land and Environment Court and I think also in the Court of Appeal. So it was a project that had everything. It was a fascinating insight into the history of Sydney, and you know, it was a project that lasted for 3 or 4 or 5 years, and the most fun bit of it, which probably wasn't the legal bit, was getting to go to the gala opening night of the Fox Studios project that we'd worked on for 3 or 4 years. So that was incredible to rub shoulders on the red carpet with all sorts of very famous people and sort of see you know, the project that we'd lived and breathed for a number of years.
That's fantastic. Yeah, it's a really cool precinct. My brother's at film school there, so
cool.
He loves the whole space.
Yeah.
So I know you just said before you were talking about how you get to cover all three of the different types, you know, litigious, advisory and transactional. Maybe you could explain that a little bit more, what you kind of focus on, and also, I guess, what advice would you give to students who are trying to decide between what areas of law they might want to go into?
Sure. So I think the first thing to say is it's really hard to know straight out of law school actually what kind of lawyer you want to be, because you really don't know what the options are. You might have some sense from some of the subjects you've studied at university that particular topics are, you know, you found it interesting to study them. But that doesn't mean at all that the legal practice of those areas is going to look anything like what you think it is going to be based on how you've studied. And, you know, the only way you can really find that is that out is to have an open mind and try a few areas and sort of trial and error to see what you think you might be interested in. And there are so many factors that affect a lawyer's choice of what area of practice is going to be for them. For some people, it's a question about what sorts of clients will I be acting for? Do I want to be acting for, you know, renewable energy developers, because I think the growth of renewable energy as a sector is, you know, an incredibly hot topic and it's going to be the thing for the next 10 years. Am I interested in tech companies, and or am I interested in the property sector, for example? So part of your choice is going to be informed by the sorts of clients that you might like to work for. But also, the I guess something that I would say to all young lawyers starting out is it's important to try and explore what type of legal practice you might be keen to work in. So to your question about the three different areas of practice, many areas in a commercial firm like ours are litigation focused. And so the way that litigation practices sort of work, they have a particular tempo. You know, you're kind of focusing towards, you're in an adversarial environment potentially. Are you heading towards a trial, in which case there are questions about, you know, needing to be very precise to be able to articulate what your client's case is or what your client's defence might be. Mm. You need to be very clear in the way you communicate, drafting pleadings and court documents. You're thinking about the admissibility of evidence, and I guess you're kind of working up to a kind of big day in court or, you know, beginning of a court hearing. So that kind of work has a particular tempo to it, and it has some sense of predictability because you're working to a timetable, but you are sort of working up to a big kind of deadline, if you like, and then once you're in court, you're all madly scrambling during the life cycle of a hearing. So that's a particular style of working and tempo of working, and it also affects the way you you write. For example, you have a particular style often of the way you write correspondence to your opposite number in litigation that might be a lot less friendly, shall we say, than in a transactional environment where it's all about helping your client and the other party come to a consensus and come to a deal if you can get there. So that's sort of, you know, the way you work and the tempo that you work at, and the things that are incredibly important in terms of detail, that's quite sort of specific in litigation. In a transactional environment, for example, or sort of by contrast, you might be dealing with really short deadlines. You've got a client who wants to do a deal to buy a business, but it's got to happen within the next 2 weeks by the end of the financial year. So everything's driven by whatever your client's commercial objectives are, or they can only get funding if certain things happen. So very often transactional practices are what we would say sort of lumpy. You know, there's an incredible period of intensity while a deal is on, working towards a deadline, but then once the deal closes or if it doesn't complete, then there's kind of a flat bed and you sort of regroup for the next thing. So some people love that sort of excitement or the tempo of the commercial side of the deal.
Yeah.
And in that sort of environment, you know, drafting letters and particular correspondence is a lot less important as part of the way you do that work. Potentially it's more about drafting transaction documents and getting the input of accountants or whatever sort of experts are relevant. So it's a different sort of style of working, and, you know, commercial or transactional lawyers will say they never want to see the inside of a courtroom, and they think that litigation work is dreadful and boring and all about sort of filling in forms and shuffling paper, and they couldn't imagine anything worse. And litigators might say that commercial lawyers are, you know, they're great sort of deal doers, but they're not necessarily concerned about precision. Now, I think both of those kind of views of things are probably unfair to both types of lawyers.
Well, you're both almost.
Yeah, but we get to do all the fun stuff. That's one of the things that I like about that. And then I guess the third category is advisory lawyers whose job is advisory by nature, and probably competition lawyers would be in that category, where their role in a transaction is to give particular advice, or tax advisors would be another example of that. So yeah, one of the things I like about our area of practice is that we get to do all of those. My practice is mainly litigation work in the Land and Environment Court, but also in the Court of Appeal and in some other jurisdictions. But there's a healthy amount of sort of strategic advisory work for clients on big projects where you sort of map out 2 or 3 years in advance. Wow. What's their strategy to navigate the process of getting all the approvals they will need to actually put a shovel in the ground and start building what they're building. And then we obviously work on component parts of whole of firm transactions where there's an acquisition of, you know, a resources business or a factory or whatever, and there are particular environmental permits and questions about planning approvals and so on that are a small but important piece of that overall transaction.
No, that's super interesting. I think people don't often know exactly what underlies each of those different areas. So I think it's really important to get that cleared up before people decide kind of what kind of person they are and where they might want to go.
Yeah. And look, you know, you don't know until you've given it a try,
yeah,
really.
True.
And so I always encourage the grads who work for us to try a transactional rotation and then try a disputes rotation, because until you've had that experience of the different styles of work and different tempo and the different sorts of things that are involved, I don't think you can really know for certain what's going to make you tick and what you're going to find not that interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And kind of on that vein, what skills do you think that you've developed kind of in your commercial career that have been the most useful?
Let's see, probably how to write clearly and for your audience. I think one of the things that all baby lawyers and not so baby lawyers struggle with when they come out of law school is when you're at university, you're taught to write in a particular way, which is designed to show, designed to show the breadth of your knowledge of a particular topic and the fact that you're alive to every relevant case or provision of a statute. So that, you know, someone who's marking your essay can say tick, 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 they've got the 10 or 12 or 20 key points across in their written answer. That's not the way clients are interested in receiving advice. They have a question and they want an answer to that question. So it's very rare that a client is going to want you to take them on every twist and turn of the journey that you have gone through to get to the answer. You know, clients are just not in the market for a 20-page or 15-page letter of advice that tells them every possibly relevant piece of legislation or case. They want to know what the answer is, and if there's not a clear answer, they want you to tell them what in your opinion the better answer is, and if there are risks or qualifications or key assumptions you've made that have guided you to that answer, you need to call them out. But other than that, you know, yes, you might have a file note that sits there so you can retrace how you got to that answer if that becomes necessary. But that's a way of communicating with a client that you flex depending on who the client is, who they are within their organisation. Are they a legal person? Are they not a legal person who is only going to read the first half a page of what you've given them? Is it somebody who needs a headline answer to pick up and insert into a much larger board paper, that sort of thing? Do you understand where that advice is going to go once your client's received it? Where's it going to go? So those sorts of skills about how to communicate to your audience, yeah, are things that I don't think you learn. Well, I certainly didn't learn at law school.
Well, there's hope for us that can't remember 100 cases in the exam, because I know that's certainly my problem.
And look, the reality is, in you know, clients hardly ever ask us a question that you know the answer to off the top of your head. If it was that simple, they wouldn't be coming to us.
Oh, why do they keep having these closed book exams then?
Exactly,
jeez.
Exactly.
You're listening to this, Sydney Uni?
You know, what you learn at university is how the concepts sort of all fit together on the jigsaw puzzle and where to start looking, but very rarely will you have learned the complete, absolute answer to a question that a client just drops on your desk and you think, aha, that's exactly what I studied and I know what the answer is. I mean, it does happen, but it doesn't happen very often.
Well, that's kind of good for my grades. So what do you think makes a really good junior lawyer? What advice could you give to students who maybe are about to start a clerkship or looking towards a grad role and thinking about how they can be really good at their job?
I think the most important attribute is to be curious and keen, because nobody expects a graduate or a summer clerk who comes in to know everything about everything. I mean, you know, the lawyers who've been here for 30 years don't know everything about everything. But I think, you know, what we look for are lawyers who are interested both in the work and in the client and why the question's being asked. So I guess that is a hint to say you should be an active listener when you get instructions from whoever's giving you the work, and you should be thinking about, does this make sense? You know, how does it fit in? If you're not sure where it fits in, you should ask a question. It's very rare in my experience that when a client gives you an instruction and asks you a question, it's very rare that you actually get 100% of the information you need to answer that question. So you always need to have your thinking cap on, saying, have I got the whole picture? Is there something I'm missing? You know, does this make sense? And so that's that sort of sense of being curious and alert and sort of intelligent enough to sort of poke and probe and test and challenge, and not be afraid to ask questions, but equally to, you know, not be afraid to give it a good go yourself. You might get it completely wrong, but at least you've used your initiative to try to work out the answer for yourself and work out, you know, sort of having a sense check of, you know, this is where I think I'm going. Am I on the right track, do you think? Or can I just check back in with you? You know, I've spent 3 hours looking at this and I don't feel like I've made any progress. This is where I thought I should be looking, but am I in completely the wrong spot? That sort of thing. I think, you know, often we see super bright young lawyers with amazing results who come out of uni who are not comfortable doing that sort of check-in or saying, I've spent a little bit of time on this, but I feel like I'm not making any headway. Can I just test that with you? I think there's it's easy for young, clever lawyers to sort of put the weight of the world on their shoulders and think they can't sort of lift their head up from their desk until they've got the perfect, complete answer. And that is a recipe for, you know, spending a lot of time potentially sort of wasting things in, you know, going down completely the wrong track. So part of that process of being inquiring and asking questions and checking back in is, from the partner's perspective, a sign of great intelligence and engagement, and, you know, to be encouraged as opposed to go away and tell me when you're finished.
Yeah.
At least that's not my style.
No, about communication. That's definitely good to hear, and sometimes a bit hard to swallow for us perfectionist law students who might want to get everything right the first time.
And I guess, that's the other point that, you know, you have to ask yourself, what does the client actually need? Not that I'm suggesting for a second you would give the client, you know, an incorrect answer, but having the nous to understand from the client's point of view, is this a bet the farm issue that you expect me to chase every rabbit down every burrow and come back to you with a treatise that is the absolute bottom line on this particular issue? Or is this an off-the-cuff question for which you're just looking for sort of a gut reaction, if you like, or a sense check before you move on to five or six other questions, any one of which might knock this whole proposal over? And again, it's sort of getting that sense of where does the work I'm doing fit into the bigger picture.
Oh, interesting. And just to kind of finish it up while we have another 5 or so minutes left, what's a really interesting area kind of in your practice?
Well, one of the things that we're spending a lot of time looking at the moment is sort of the future of cities. What do cities look like? So part of the work we do in the planning part of our practice is all about people, you know, what's the next generation of built form in our city going to look like, whether it's housing or offices or warehouses or transport infrastructure or whatever it is. And one of the amazing things that we've seen over the last sort of 5 to 10 years, and it's gathering incredible pace now, is the impact that technology has on the way and technological developments have on what the city of the next decade and the next generation is going to look like. So, for example, 15, 20 years ago, there was no such thing as an autonomous car, for example, but now they're here. There are autonomous passenger vehicles like taxis operating in Sydney right now in parts of the Westmead precinct, for example.
Really? I had no idea.
You know, driverless buses.
Wow.
In the Sydney Olympic precinct, for example. 10 years ago, nobody had heard of ride sharing or go-get or car sharing, and yet now that's that there are all sorts of providers all across Sydney. And that's so that changes what we build and where we build it. So, for example, if you're building an apartment building, you know, 20 years ago, if you built an apartment building in the city of Sydney, you'd have one or two car spaces per apartment in a basement underground. Now you can't get any basement car parking approved because the city of Sydney says nobody drives cars in the city of Sydney anymore.
Wow.
So you might have to provide a very small basement with lots of ride-sharing car spaces. You'll probably have electric vehicle charging points, and you'll probably have 50 bicycle parking spaces. But, you know, it changes the design of what we build. It changes the assumptions we make about how roads are going to be used, how much traffic is there going to be on the roads. Where do we put bus stops? Where do we put petrol stations? Do we need petrol stations? Where do we put electric vehicle charging stations? So all of that stuff about sort of technology that you might look at and think, well, that's rocket science of the future. It's actually affecting the way cities are designed and being arranged right now. And, you know, you can't walk through central Sydney without seeing the impact of the changes to transport infrastructure, and that is transforming what sort of the next bits of Sydney are going to look like in terms of creating, you know, heavy rail connections to bits of Sydney where it's never been before. So suddenly you can have much denser areas of population and schools and retirement villages, and suddenly retirement villages are in a 10-storey building because we do them vertically rather than in sort of landscape settings as we've done before. So so you can sort of see technology changing what you do in real time.
Oh, that's so fascinating. It must be so interesting to be at the real forefront of how our cities are
looking. It's a bit scary as well because, you know, the rules don't keep up, and so part of what we have to do is deal with a planning system that assumes land use has changed the same. So, you know, having at Amazon is another classic example. Mm. 5 years ago, nobody ever knew what a fulfillment centre is. And yet now there are ginormous warehouses all over Sydney where people like Amazon have their enormous distribution centres, or, you know, our clients in the grocery sector have their distribution centres for home delivery. It's completely changing what kind of land uses you put where.
Wow, that's super, super interesting. Well, I think we may have run out of time, but I just wanted to say a massive thank you for coming on to the podcast. We really appreciate your time, and it was really fascinating to talk to you.
It's my pleasure.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.